You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Jeff Lewis. Jeff, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to it for a long time, listening to your show for quite a while. So,
It's great to be a
guest.
That's neat. We really don't know what the exact coverage is of our shows because there's nobody who really monitors the radio frequencies in this area because they're all the for-profit ones are owned by one company.
Got it.
So let's cut to the show. What we begin with is a big question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the life you aspire to live, the values, the labels you worn, the things you've done? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
Well, that's a big question, right? I mean, I'm 58 and a half, and I've been trying to figure that out for probably 50 years. But I think most of us define ourselves in two ways, at least this is how I think about it. One is what we do, and the other is how we relate to other people individually. So we can take the first one first, if you like.
Sure.
So for the last 25 years, I've practiced oral and maxillofacial surgery in Ithaca, and I've been the director of the Cougar Medical Center Cleft Palate and Facial Deformities Team and Clinic. And if you include my time in training, I've been operating on people for over 32 years. But you invited me to the show at a really, really interesting inflection point in my career and what I do, because as of the beginning of January, I became the full-time medical director for RACR. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for the listeners who don't know RACR, it's a not-for-profit agency that employs about 1,000 people and supports approximately 3,500 people with developmental disabilities. So that's autism, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, other genetic disorders, and things like that. So it's a real shift in some ways in the kind of work that I do. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm finding it to be an incredibly comfortable fit. I'm starting to realize that a lot of the skill sets that I had as a surgeon, other than operating on people, right, is completely transferable to this.
Sure.
So, but the feeling is different. When you go into surgery, you're mm-hmm. a bit like a fighter pilot. You know how to take off, fly, and land the plane, but there are bad things being shot at you the whole time, and you're right, trying to avoid disaster.
Right.
This is much more cognitive and collaborative and conversational, non-conflict-oriented type of work, and I really, really love it.
So. Cool. Much of the intensity, but not the desperation.
That's a great way to characterize it.
I mean, because when you have a patient in an operation, you have to make things happen yesterday.
Yeah, it's like, and that is one adjustment, is when I've talked to the folks that I work with at RACR, and all of them are fantastic. And they'll bring a problem to me, and I'll say, okay, here's some things I think we should do. Let's roll this out, and I'll check back a week later, which is a really long time in the life of a surgeon.
Sure, sure.
And they'll say, no, we're working with the state 3 months before we get an answer. Sure. And as a surgeon, I'm like, I need an answer right now.
Right.
And also the interesting contrast is, at least for me, and I think this is true for most surgeons, when you go in to actually start the operation, you become really emotionally detached.
Right.
I think that's the only way you can effectively do what you do and remain intact otherwise. But with this other work, totally
right. That person on the table engaged is not your beloved.
Right.
Otherwise, you could not do with the tools what you have to do.
That's right. Because surgery is injuring people.
Yes. Yeah.
Therapeutic injury.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And there are times when we injure our beloveds by picking issues and things that we very much need to address. But that's you know, those are the sacred times that we set right aside and do in a special space.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the other part is how do we identify ourselves?
Relationally.
Relationally. Yeah. So I think about the different people in my life that I care about and who I am to them. So I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a son, an uncle. When I study those relationships, it's all, you know, it's really all about feelings, exchanging ideas, how we treat each other. I've certainly learned that far more difficult than being a surgeon is being a parent.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hardest job in the world. There's no training manual, and you don't have to get a license to do it. So that's been an interesting ride.
Right. So what has it challenged in you that you were not prepared?
I had this preconception. My wife and I were married almost over 10 years before we had our first child. We'd kind of given up hope, and then she was pregnant with our son, who will be 22 in February. And, we have all these preconceived notions of what being a parent is going to be like, and those are mostly shattered one after the next by actually having a child. So
right.
I imagined this, you know, unicorns and rainbows at the moment of birth, and it would be this instant bonding, and I absolutely adore my son, but when I held him for the first time, I looked at this little being, and like, we didn't know each other.
Right, right.
And so it took a little while to, like, feel connected.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So that was interesting, and that was repeated when we had our daughter, too. So, and she'll be 18 in February, mm-hmm. instead of 4 years apart. Yeah. I also learned that, you have this idea that if you're a really good parent and you devote yourself and you put in the time and attention and all that, that it will create this outcome. And I have really learned that you have very little to do with the outcome as long as you're not, as long as you don't treat your kids badly. So you can
right.
treat them well, but they're their own people with their own ideas and their own temperament. With two kids who have two completely different temperaments, but it was the same food on the table, the same right. conversations.
Or not, because they're different temperaments and it's yeah. not the same conversation.
Yeah.
yeah.
But so I've learned from that over time to try to control less and just be responsive and encouraging.
Right, right, right. That the temptation to shape, to control,
right,
is
right.
really, really hard. I suffer from it and have suffered from it enormously. You brought some music with you.
Yes.
So we're going to open with Steely Dan's Home at Last from the Asia album.
Thank
Did you.
You
want to say anything about that, or shall we just...
I chose that song because Steely Dan lyrics are often ambiguous, and there's double entendres and all that, so I'd say forget the lyrics other than the concept of having peace when you get home. But musically, that Asia album is probably the best thing in rock that I've ever heard. It's produced but not overproduced, and I'm a bass player, and Chuck Rainey has just a sweet bass line on this song.
Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Jeff Lewis. So, Jeff, you already alluded maybe to the punchline or the big lesson learned. But given this life that you have come to value, what were some of the experiences early on you had to have in order to know the life you wanted to live and to have the skills to live it?
Okay, and that's a complex question.
What did you have to learn to live the life you value now?
One thing I did learn from my parents was a really strong work ethic. Mm-hmm. I should clarify for a minute. So I have four parents. I have no step-parents. I have four parents, my two biological parents and my two parents that were married. My biological parents, when they got divorced, they got divorced when I was probably two, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't really remember.
So you don't remember life much without four parents.
That's right.
Yeah.
And they both got remarried when I was about four, so I really don't remember not having four parents. My two fathers, Stu is my biological father, and mm-hmm. Herb is my other father. He's a physician. He's still alive. He's in his 90s now, the most brilliant man I've ever met. We have Google, but I had Herb. I had my dad. We didn't need Google back when I was growing up because you had him in the house. But from both my fathers, I learned that the world doesn't owe you anything. You're not entitled to anything, but you can have almost anything you want if you're willing to work hard enough for it. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what I was given by them as kind of a groundwork. But I learned a little bit later in life, and it was a very painful lesson, but valuable to me in the end, was greed is a real sin. And at a couple of instances, one in particular, with somebody relatively close in my life who was unbelievably greedy and evil. And I do believe that a lot of greed can breed evil in people. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This was not a family member or a friend. It was a business partner. Mm-hmm. And what I saw was horrifying, and it was incredibly instructive, and it created an inflection point in my life. So this was when I was in practice in California. When I left that, I committed myself to creating a completely different culture. Mm-hmm. That was completely void of greed and focused much more on gratitude and giving. So when I created my practice here, I tried to create that culture in mm-hmm. my practice. And mm-hmm. for the many patients who I've had the honor to take care of over the years, I think many of them have reflected on that, how great a staff I had, how caring they were, and I tried my best to treat them the best that I could.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you had that experience with the climber greed?
Yeah, it was between age 32 and I moved back here when I was 34, 1994, mm-hmm. so young 30s.
Right.
I've been exposed to greed from other people, but it was more distant earlier on. I always found it distasteful, but when it was this close.
Well, your business partner, you're implicated in it.
Right.
It touches you.
Yeah.
You wallow in it to some extent.
I wasn't an employee, I was a partner.
Yeah. You are it.
Right.
And
it's remarkable how evil people can help. Yeah. You know, the worst things that happen to us in life, this is my observation, are the things that other people do to you. You know, we have natural disasters and illness and all that. But when facing those, we can kind of get together and work through them. But there's some unbelievably unkind things that people do to each other. And it's
Right. But I would qualify what you said just ever so slightly. And sure. it's the things that other people do to us that we were just marginally complicit in. It's when we have participated in our own demise that we are our own damaging. Even if we couldn't have stopped it, but we actually participated in it.
Right.
That's like poison. And it's very hard to kind of acknowledge, you know, they did what they did and, you know, good or evil, they have theirs to came out, but I have mine to kind of clean out and restore. And so I would just qualify it in that one slight way.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But you were implicated with a partner too. I mean, so you were touched in that.
Right. I made the choice. Yeah. I signed the papers. Yeah. I wrote the check.
Yeah.
So
yeah. When you are completely overwhelmed by somebody you cannot protect yourself from, that's a different story.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So, let's so that experience of choosing gratitude over greed, to make a living, and to actually make a life. What other kinds of lessons? And you had the work ethic from your parents,
right?
But also, what gave you an interest in knowing people as they are, as opposed to as you would want them to be?
That, I think, is largely just my temperament. I think I came out that way. If you were to know my dad, Stu, who many in Ithaca would have known, he was a businessman locally, and he died 3 years ago in April. He was a larger-than-life character, but he never met a stranger.
Right.
And it embarrassed me when I was a kid. I mean, he would do all these things that were crazy and funny. But as a kid, you know, you're a little embarrassed when your father's
the center of attention.
Yeah, but he was always good to other people. And then as I got older and I realized, man, his ability to connect with people is just otherworldly, and it's powerfully positive. And so I think some of that is in my natural temperament. I've always been really interested in other people, what motivates them, what makes them create decisions that they do, how they treat other people. Mm-hmm. And so, like my father, Stu, if I'm standing around and waiting for something to happen, there are people, I'm curious. I might ask, you know, ask somebody, oh, well, how come you decided to come to the show? Or, you know,
right, or nice hat.
Where'd you get that? You know, that type of thing. Yep. Rather than just stand there and not. So I think I just came by that. That was hardwiring.
Right. But what I'm struck by is how that openness and curiosity gets derailed when you're invested in your own children.
All right, say that one again.
You had talked about how it was hard to let go of control,
right,
with your children,
right?
And yet, if you were just out with other, I have a similar issue. You know, anybody else in the world, and I'm going to get your story, and I'm going to get your story. You're just going to come and tell it to me for some reason I don't fully understand. People just find it helpful to tell me their stories,
right,
and have done so since I was as young as I can remember, 4 or 5 years old. But with my own kids, I don't only want their own stories, which we would get, but I want them to take them in particular ways that I think would be good for them.
Right. Well, I can tell you a story I've told a few times. When my son, he's really, really bright and unbelievably articulate. And when he got to about his senior year of high school, like any 17-year-old male, it's time to push back. And so he's pushing back.
If he didn't push back, you'd worry.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But when you're going through it as a parent, you're like, well, what's it? Why does he want to? He never did anything bad. He was just picking fights. And he and I joke about this now. And it's like, I just want to talk to you. I don't want to pick a fight. And so the night before we drove him down to drop him off at college, I took him out to dinner. He and I have this ritual that father and son go out for dinner. We sit and talk, and we have these great conversations and enjoy food. He loves to try all kinds of wide cuisines. So I said to him, look, I don't want to get too heavy, but we're handing you off, right? So I want to make it clear to you that I have spent the first 18 years of your life doing what I thought was my job as your father, which is to tell you what to do and how to do it. Because you came into this world not knowing anything, didn't know what to do or how to do it. But I want you to know I'm done with that chapter. The next chapter is to be here to guide you and support you. I'll give you advice if you ask for it, but I'll do my best not to give you my advice unless you ask for it. So what do you think? And he just kind of smiled with a little smirk, and he said, well, you certainly fulfilled your obligation the first 18 years. We'll see how it goes after that. So since then, I've really worked hard to listen, ask good questions, and not tell him what to do.
Right.
And he'll listen to the show and let me know later, I guess, how I'm doing. But I think it's going pretty well. And he's made great decisions. And so that's been the easy part as a parent.
Well, and letting I started the process of framing decisions. My daughter wanted to be involved in two different sports, play two instruments, be involved in a chorus, and all of this was in fourth grade. I mean, and so I said, you know, it's you're going to have to figure this one out. You want to do everything. You're convinced you can do everything, and she, but you're going to do it through this semester.
Right.
And she took it on and she did it, and at the end she said, "I'll never do that again."
That's too much.
But I've had that kind of a rapport, and right. and where it stays there, it's good, right. And that's a rapport you can, like you're doing now, you can right. live right through old age with.
Well, and I can relate to that because our daughter Anna is she's a doer, and she's very musical and. There was a point at which you wanted to keep doing, adding more and more.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, look, there's only 24 hours in a day, right. and we're big on sitting down and having dinner together and all these activities after mm-hmm. school in the evenings. So there were a couple times where we had to say, let's scale back on that and just focus on spending a little time.
Right.
But one thing from the experience with my son that I learned to dial back on the telling what to do and how
right.
to do it
right.
with our daughter.
Right.
So that's been a joy.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's yeah. we... They don't come with, you know, we don't come with the manual loaded into our brains,
right.
and there's no manual. So,
right.
Yeah.
I do remember being in college and coming home and saying the most unbelievably stupid things to my parents. And to their credit, they just kind of, they didn't even look up over the newspaper. Just kind of like, let it go. So, I realized with teenagers and young adults, they try to poke at you a little bit.
Right.
Sometimes the best thing is just,
and it's and sometimes it is genuinely poking at, especially if they've been poked
right
up front.
Right.
But sometimes it's just, let me try this, see what this sounds like.
Right.
You know, let me just see how this weird thing plays.
Right.
You know, and it's not personal at all, which
right.
is something I have a thin enough skin that sometimes I take it personal. It's
right.
not. It's not. What should we play next here?
Let's go with Arco Arena by Cake.
Okay.
I love that band. They're a little irreverent, and this is short and sweet, instrumental.
Sure.
That's just got something I've never heard before.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Jeff Lewis. So, Jeff, you were giving us some of the things that you've had to experience to know the life you wanted to live. I wondered, was there anything more on that list? Because we kind of just ambled around, which is perfectly fine.
I had this very unusual, not very unusual, but I had a somewhat unusual path through education and training. And people that met me once I was in practice here thought it was some grand design and a linear path. And most of it was that I guess I've never been the smartest one in the room, but I was always pretty smart at seeing great opportunities. So mm-hmm. I was an undergrad, didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I loved biology. I've always been a tinkerer, so I mm-hmm. said, okay, I'm going to go to dental school. I had a grandfather who's a dentist. As I mentioned, my dad is a physician, so I had good role models there. Mm-hmm. But I was the one to take a toy apart and put it back together before playing with it, so I thought dentistry would be great. I was going to be a general dentist. Mm-hmm. And then I had great mentorship while I was in dental school by a couple of people who pulled me aside and said, no, we're going to ruin your plans. You're going to be a surgeon, and specifically, you're going to go to medical school. So I finished dental school and went to medical school to become an oral surgeon. And during that odyssey of experience, which uh-huh. was medical school, general surgery, oral and maxillofacial right. surgery, again, there were mentors who pulled me aside and said, I'm going to ruin your plans. You're going to do a fellowship in facial plastic surgery. So it was just a series of seeing great opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I, as brutal as surgical training is, I just loved every minute of it. And you know, then I came out of the gate. I'm like, okay, I have all this education and training. Now I've got to figure out what I'm going to do with it.
Right.
Which is why I ended up on the West Coast. I felt I needed to be in a big metropolitan area.
With lots of different practice opportunities. And
yeah, and just a huge population base so right. I could do everything I was trained. What I learned through that other unpleasant experience was I decided what I really wanted to do was have a practice with a culture that I wanted. And so when I moved right. back here, I found that it, you know, it's kind of like the field of dreams. Mm-hmm. Build mm-hmm. it and they will come.
Right.
So I was able to do all of those things here in Ithaca.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So I want to go back to I almost interrupted you in the telling of your story because
sure.
you got to dental school.
Right.
And the way you framed it as you see opportunities, but the way you told the story was somebody told you we're shattering your dreams here. We're
right.
going to send you on another. You actually put it in the voice of another person. Was that indeed the case? Were there other people who actually told you? So how did you become the kind of person that can hear that order to change your plans?
Well, in that case, this was a result of my work ethic. So I did a rotation that was down at the hospital, University of Pennsylvania. And my thing was, if the guy in charge says, show up tomorrow at 7:30, I'm showing up at 7. I want to make sure I'm there on
right,
time.
Right, right. I probably show up at 7:15, but yeah.
And so after an entire summer of that, I think he saw potential and willingness to work hard and whatever else. And so he saw potential in me I hadn't probably seen in myself. And there was another mentor at Penn back in the dental school who the same thing, kind of pulled me aside and said, you know, what your plans are great, but I think these would be greater plans for you. And I would just, mm-hmm. I've been pretty good at listening to people. And I've seen bad advice. I know when to stay away from that. Mm-hmm. But when somebody would open a door of opportunity, I'm pretty good at imagining the future.
Right.
Just kind of daydreaming and with a positive narrative. I'm like, yeah, that would be really, really cool to pursue.
Right. Right. So. But there's a piece here. You want to do something well,
right.
and you show up to do it, but you're not particularly willful the way you describe it about your future. Willful people get on. I mean, there's right. a lot of willfulness, and you don't come from the kind of rural poverty that I come from without a certain amount of willfulness, and learning how to give it up is a major life lesson.
Right.
But.
I would say I was very willful. I'd see the door of opportunity open. Once I walk through it, I am running full force. And that has been, that's kind of been how my life has unfolded. So
right.
when I get committed to something, mm-hmm. even recreationally.
Right. So how do people get in there and whisper in your ear and say, you know, I think this could be better? How do they get your attention?
It just, in my case, the times it's happened, it's being with, they've all been really good people. And I could sense that. And so, you're in good shape if you trust good people.
Right.
You're in bad shape if you trust bad people. So these are really good people who I aspired to be like,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I worked with them. I thought, mm-hmm. wow, that's a tremendous amount of skill. That's a tremendous amount of devotion. I like how they treat other people. So I could see like, yeah, I would like to be like that. And then when they gave me the opportunity and the push, like I said, once I got through the door, I would push pretty hard.
So how does this all add up to Racker Center?
So yeah, this is a funny story. My practice full fledged. I'm busier than I can can stand, and trying to dial back on that. And I get a phone call from the executive director, Dan Brown. And I've known Dan for a long time. I was on the board of Racker for 6 years going back about 12 years ago. So I thought, Dan left a message to call him back, and I thought it was a fundraising call. I'm like, okay, it's time to write a check. And then, so Dan and I are chit-chatting, and he just said, you know, we would like you to be our next medical director. The previous medical director felt the need to move on, and I said, Dan, I have a full-time job. I mean, this is untenable. He said, just come talk to me. So I went up to his office, and we sat there for after about 2 hours. He had convinced me that it was, in fact, something I really wanted to do. It's just a matter of how to do it. I was at a point in my career where I was taking Mondays off, and so I thought, okay, it's described as an 8 to 10 hour a week job. I can give you Mondays and some weekend time. And nothing was time sensitive, you know, unlike surgery where you get a phone call, you got to be there right now. This was more project type of work. So I got in there, and after about 3 months, I was really loving the work, but I also had identified many things that weren't getting done. I envisioned the medical directorship to be much more proactive rather than reactive. Mm-hmm. And so I came to Dan at our monthly meeting and I said, look, here's a list of major things that really need to get done. The problem is they can't get done in 8 or 10 hours a week. And Dan, you know, ever the calm, and he's a great leader. He's, you know, a calm hand on the throttle in a raging sea. He just smiled and he said, well, when can we have you full time? Completely caught me off guard. So I took a walk that night with my wife and she said, do it. I said, when? She said, now. I said, well, it takes about a year to wrap up a practice. So she said, well, let's get going. So I made the decision, and we looked at our finances and the age of our kids. And I, you know, this was one of those things where if I said, Dan, you need to wait 3 or 4 or 5 years, which was my original plan.
Sure.
I knew the opportunity wasn't going to be there. So here's, again, the door
he
of opportunity.
Yeah.
Door of opportunity opens. Mm-hmm. I knew I could work with Dan as a great partner. And So we wound it down, and now as of January, I'm full-time up there. So.
Right. So the curiosity about people isn't just about people. It's also about opportunities and how they line up and how the people line up with the opportunities.
Yeah. I've always been fascinated by how people get to where they are in their lives. What choices did they make? What were accidents that they didn't make choices over and things like that?
And have you made... Have there been opportunities that weren't where you made a missed call?
I'd have to think about
that's not where you the one dealing with greed is not a it's a learning. There's things you have to learn. Have there been things that you thought were opportunities that just proved to not be?
Yeah, I think that example of having gone into practice with the wrong person. Mm-hmm. I had many opportunities coming out of training, and I had, you know, kind of flown around the country and interviewed in a bunch of different practices. I considered full-time academia. And my mentor, I should have listened to my mentor when I was in training. He said, you need to be in practice yourself, not with a group. And I said, yeah, but I like working with other people. This collaboration's been great. And he said, yeah, but it won't end up that way. You have a pretty strong personality. You have some very clear ideas about what you want to do and how you want to do it. Mm-hmm. And just trust me, that's not going to play well. But you're going to have to learn the hard way. And he was right. So I decided to join a group. You heard the other part of the story.
Right. So, but it brings an interesting issue up, and that is... in your curiosity, you project a quality of collaborative work,
right?
But do you have a genuine peer, or do you, or have you grown past that young needing to be completely in charge?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that came, I don't know, it was 10 or 15 years ago, but I was in my practice and I was kind of micromanaging things. And then I had an epiphany one day. That's a long story how that epiphany came, but I had an epiphany and I realized, man, I'm surrounded by some really, really talented people.
So how did that epiphany, I'm just going to push back because this is interesting.
How did it happen?
How did that epiphany happen that you don't need to micromanage really good people?
The short version is we would have a weekly meeting on Mondays to go over every patient we were going to see for the entire week. And I always attended that meeting. I didn't necessarily run the meeting, but what I didn't realize till later was when a question was unanswered, the staff always deferred to me. And usually it's like, if you hand me the chart and show me the x-ray, I can kind of tell you everything about the patient. And then there was some time when I couldn't be there. I had some other commitment, and I said, you're going to have the Monday meeting without me. And I'm a pretty good observer of what goes on around. And I realized that week went unbelievably well. And the reason is every one of my staff members owned those decisions about those patients without deferring to me. Wow. So they knew more about, when they walked in the room, when they walked in the office, everybody knew who the patient was. Everybody knew that their lab work was back and that I had signed off on it and that the models from the dentist's office were here. They owned it when I wasn't there, and the light bulb went on. I realized I have really good people. I need to get out of the way. And I had the conversation with them. I said, when I walk in the office, don't allow me to do anything other than make diagnoses and talk with patients and operate on them. Don't let me do any of those other things because you guys are better at it, mm-hmm. and it's not a great use of my time.
Right.
And you really want me doing things that are going to be productive for the practice, and that benefits everybody. So that was how that happened.
Well, your example illustrates perfectly how you pull back your personal boundaries so you don't have to own everything. You
right.
can let other people just be other people. Right. So, but there's also a quality, and it's more like you're talking with Dan or with your mentors, where they're your mentors or he's your potential employer, but you're also batting with them fairly equal. I mean,
right.
how do you pulling back your boundaries from taking charge is not the same as collaborating.
Right. Well,
how do you went into this role with Racker with like a 1 day a week trial.
Right.
That proved to be a trial that may right. or may not have been in Dan's mind.
Right. Right. So how
do you collaborate with people? I mean, given the fact that you have a strong personality and you're skillful,
right.
How do you collaborate? How do you find those collaborations that are really productive so you don't overwhelm people and you also don't leave stuff undone that could be easily done?
Sure. Well, with Racker, I have so many different roles there, but one of them, I'll give you an example, one of them is to provide guidance and oversight to our staff of 13 nurses. Mm-hmm. One of those nurses oversees all the other 12, and she's the one, her name is Kathy Oberlander. She's unbelievably talented, and I told her she can't retire until I retire. There's no way. But instead of walking in and kind of telling her what I thought she should be doing, I said, let's create a partnership where you tell me where I can support you. You understand Racker better than I do. You've been attending to the healthcare needs of our 144 residents and 26 homes for a long time. But surely there's help you need. Help me identify what those areas are, and I will support you. And if I need help from you, I'll ask you. And then let's talk about, there's a project we're doing now. And I said, once we get the data, I would like to sit down with you and get your input on the data. I can tell you what I found. And let's figure out then how to communicate right. this to other people.
You just defined a covenant relationship. In a covenant relationship, you do for others what they cannot do for themselves. And you ask from others what you cannot do for yourself.
Right.
And you don't do others what they can do for themselves because that just gets in the way and it disempowers them.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think I could have done this in my 30s.
But it's also what makes a marriage work.
Yes.
And we tend not to see the similarities in the different settings. And it's also part of what makes parenting work.
Right.
Because those kids who know nothing need to learn that they know a little more than they may have assumed, but they still, right. on some level, know nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that makes sense. I mean, my wife and I have been married 33 years in June, and it's great. And we figured out in our first year when we were struggling a little bit about picking at each other over nothing, we developed this thing called the one boss rule. I'm a really good worker bee if I know that I'm not in charge.
Right.
And she's a really good worker bee, but she likes to be in charge, and so did I. So we figured out whatever the project is, if we're starting to poke at each other, who's the boss? So,
I would have avoided two divorces had I learned that rule early in life.
You should have called me back 33 years ago.
I was probably so willful that I might not have listened to you.
I'm just thankful she and I figured it out early.
Yeah, that's sweet. That's very sweet. Let's cut to music, and then I want to talk about self-care.
Okay.
So shall we do Badge?
Yeah, let's go with Badge by Cream. Great bass line, nonsensical lyrics.
Here we go.
Thinking about the times you drove in my car, thinking that I might have drove you too about the swans that they live in the park. Then I told you about our kid, now he's married to Mabel.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Jeff Lewis. So, Jeff, the way we close out the show is with a discussion of how do you take care of yourself physically, intellectually, emotionally, which when you put those three orthogonal things together, then right. You've got spiritual. That's kind of my way of kind of putting three orthogonal items together, and then you've got a three-dimensional object, which is kind of the depth of a spiritual person. That's the way I would put it. You don't need to go there. But how do you take care of yourself? When do you know you need to do it? Are there things you do throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly basis? You know, this is just...
Sure.
We'll start and we'll go wherever we go.
I would say it's the three M's. Movement, music, and meditation. Now, a few years ago, the three M's would have been movement, music, and motorcycles. but I stopped riding motorcycles around when I was 50, after having ridden 110,000 miles around the roads of the U.S. for the previous decade.
Wow. And you still have the spine to tell.
the roads were getting worse and cell phone use was increasing, so I thought this is a good time to exit that. I loved it. Right. And in terms of spirituality, meditation, whatever... there are experiences riding out in the back roads on a motorcycle that change your brain chemistry. But these days I would say movement, which is mostly for me walking and hiking, mm-hmm. working out in the gym, so to speak, too. But I really love taking long walks. Mm-hmm. I find it mentally relaxing. I can clear my head and actually complete thoughts in my head. And the physicality of it is good.
How often do you, and where do you go?
Well, when the weather's good, it's every day, and sometimes it'll be for a couple of hours, mm-hmm. but it's usually at least 45 minutes to an hour. Right. Depending on other time commitments, just right out of the front door of my house.
Sure.
I live out in Lansing, and so there's loops in the neighborhood you can get in a few miles pretty easily, like Sapsucker Woods. Mm-hmm. Going down to the gorges and things like that. We live in a great area for hiking and that type of thing. The music part is I play bass guitar in a band, and that's a great collaboration, a lot of fun. I write some music on my own and just play. And have a little music room in the house. I go down at night and play. And that is, it takes your mind off everything else. And there's movement involved with that too. Mm-hmm. So I find that to be a self-care type of thing.
Yeah.
And the meditation is not like transcendental meditation, which I do hope to actually, now that I have a little more time, mm-hmm. Control, actually learn to do that as a practice. But the meditative part of long walks, mm-hmm. if I'm, my wife and I walk a lot together, but if I walk myself, I just get on a subject in my mind and just kind of let it float with undirected, and I find that to be helpful. It helps me think more clearly about the other things, the transactional things I need to get done in my life. I think I'm better at that when I've had time to meditate.
Yeah, and there's a whole there's a whole literature on walking meditation and how it works. I mean, it's not. I mean, that's a standard form, the way TM or, you know, other forms of meditation would be.
And I think this is, you know, runners who run recreationally, they get into kind of a mental meditative state as well. I don't run anymore just because the joints, being a surgeon is it's a bit of a blue collar type of work. So the neck and back and legs can take a beating, and mine had over the years. So too many running injuries, but walking is good.
Right.
Less pounding.
Right. And I have a kind of a routine 3 mile walk that I will do. And part of me likes novelty, but part of me also likes this brutal consistency, because then I notice when the branches are broken or the trees or whatever, or something has changed in the environment.
Absolutely.
But my meditation is to just disappear, and I disappear in a place that's familiar to me. And when something startles me, then it brings me out, and I suddenly notice things I hadn't noticed before, just because I have been so deeply immersed in whatever place I go to.
That perfectly describes what I didn't put into words as well. Oh. I think of the experience I have when I'm doing that kind of walking.
Yeah, and it, to me, it is really at least 40 minutes and ideally an hour, but sometimes it doesn't work out that way.
Right.
But and sometimes it works out for 2 hours, cause, so I pack my walking in for the days I don't get it.
Right.
So what do you do to take care of your mind? I mean, meditation is part of that, but what do you do to kind of to work out the mental acuity and the subtlety and the recognition of different kinds of stuff?
I do a lot of reading. I've always been a readaholic. I always have a queue of books, and I'm piling more of them on before I finish them. In the last many years, it's been a lot of nonfiction. So, you know, I'll find a topic that interests me and read a lot about it and try to really, really understand the components of it in my mind, and I think that keeps my mind sharp. Lately, it's been the U.S. Constitution.
And books about the Constitution or about...
The Constitution itself and books about the Constitution, the Federalist Papers and things like that, because some of the teaching I do is on healthcare economics and public policy, so understanding what rights really are and what that term means is important. So
for intellectual work to be kind of a spiritual discipline, it has to change who you are. What about the rights? What's new to you? What is it? What have you seen that you didn't see before you started reading?
Oh, you want me to come back to an hour on the Constitution?
Well,
So there are certain clauses.
Or medical related. I mean, what really caught my interest is the medical related rights.
Right.
And because what are really rights? Because that's I don't think we throw words around.
Right.
In transactional ways,
right,
rather than in symbolic or relational ways.
Right.
And
as a friend of mine just said the other night to me, well, is that a semantic issue or is it really a definition issue? So we talk about rights when often what we really mean is moral imperatives, and they're different.
Right.
At least in the United States, our rights are codified in the Constitution. And so it's an interesting document to read because of how it's written and how it's structured. And it's, I think, brilliant. We have a lot of moral imperatives. You know, we talk basic human rights are moral imperatives, but they're not actually protected depending on which society you live in.
Right. And depending upon whether the Supreme Court has extended the definition out to cover moral imperatives on a particular issue or not.
Right. I'm reading a book now called The Most Dangerous Branch, and it's about how dangerous the Supreme Court is. Is it taking more power than the executive or legislative branches? I'm only halfway through, so
yeah,
I don't have
an
answer for you.
And these are tough issues. I'm a practical kind of guy, a pragmatic kind of guy. In terms of the number one healthcare provider in your life, who is that?
My primary care physician. You want his name?
No, okay. But I'm going to challenge you on that.
Okay.
Your number one healthcare
provider. Probably my wife, actually.
In terms of economic value, the number one healthcare provider in your life
is yourself. Me. Yeah, absolutely.
And then usually it's your spouse or an adult child or a parent if it's a child. And then you get into paid professional care 2, 3, 4 layers down, depending upon. And we have never had a healthcare debate and any kind of moral imperative or right to healthcare in this country, which really looked at how healthcare is provided.
Right.
Most of it's provided with unpaid labor.
Right.
And it's in time that we spend doing things or other things that we need very much to do to have a life and to have relationships.
And it's the same thing with raising children. It's unmonetized and you can't leverage it. So
we need to have that debate because we will never really deal with healthcare issues until we really consider how it's provided and how we, as you were saying, how can I help you, to the nurse or to your wife?
Right.
You know, if I'm not in charge here, you are. So tell me how I can help you. How can we approach people in that way so that we are open to each other's needs and can respond to them, whether or not we're paid?
Right.
I'm rambling. That's my soapbox. But that's part of where I live my life, is kind of seeing the nexus of these issues that are transactional, but they're also not transactional at all.
Well, when I'm invited to give lectures, those are the things I'm trying to unpack. So, and I go in the classroom and I tell the students, I'm not here to tell you what to think, but I do want to help you think about how to think about it, and understanding definitions and words and structure of what we have is important. So that's really what I see my role as, a facilitator of clearer thinking.
Right, And as you do that for yourself, I don't read many books. Some, but I read an hour every day, but I don't necessarily read books. And that keeps you fresh. How do you take that into a place like the Racker Center, or where do you teach? Because academia was a road not taken for you.
Another big role there for me is teaching. So it's educating different types of staff about maybe one issue. We might pick an issue like Down syndrome.
Sure.
So I teach a Down syndrome to one group of people in a slightly different way than I would to the others. Nurses are medically educated and trained, so I can use a lot of medical lingo and be very efficient. And I may be talking to lay people about the challenges of somebody with Down syndrome and their medical issues, and I have to change up the narrative a little bit because I have to use different vocabulary. So that's been fun and interesting, and that keeps my mind sharp. I have to think a lot about.
And it sounds like life is a wonderful exercise in play.
Yes. When it's good, you're doing a lot of play.
Right. So there's playing, there's seeking behavior, and those are the two, and then there's sensual sexual behavior, and those are the three biggies where we really get charged. And caring also provides the same sort of jazz to us.
Right.
And you seem to have made a life in all four of those.
Right now it feels pretty good. Yeah, I feel I have a lot of gratitude about how my life has been.
And when you were, what I realized is your emotional peer support is probably as much your band as it is anybody else.
Yeah,
including your spouse and kids.
It's certainly like having siblings. I mean, we've had our fights.
But support doesn't mean it's pretty.
But let me tell you, the laughter that comes out of that four of us getting together on a regular basis is unbelievable. We say, you know, basically, the music is an excuse to go down to the State Diner and have late night dinner and laugh at each other.
Yeah, do you find these are informal? It's a band, so it's minimally formalized, but it's mostly informal. Are there other places where you go for more formal support or more formal community?
Not really. I mean, I have a few very close friends, and I see them regularly, and that would be my community. It's not like I'm a member of Temple Beth El, and that's an important part of my life in a different way. But
it's a part of your identity, too.
It's certainly a part of my identity, an important one. But I have a few close friends, and keeping them close and seeing them regularly and pushing each other to be better, that's hugely supportive.
Yeah.
And I know that, you know, if they had a problem, I'd drop what I was doing to be there for them and vice versa. Yeah. Having a few people like that in your life is powerful.
Right. Right, and that is another shtick that we could get on. people need 30 to 70 people in their lives in varying degrees of closeness. We almost all have more than we think once right. you start actually counting, and that's daily, right. weekly, monthly, quarterly, yearly, once every 5 years, all the people that are that we own and right. that who own us.
Right.
Jeff, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
We're going to close out. You brought Rhiannon. I never pronounced that right.
Yeah, Rhiannon. That's Fleetwood Mac song. Again, it's more about the music than the lyrics for me, and I've loved this song since the 70s.
Okay, here we go. Thank you.